Looking for another podcast to check out? We recommend For Real from Book Riot. History buff Alice and library employee Kim are your hosts, and each week they recommend readable, approachable, and fun nonfiction. The longer the subtitle, the better. They cover everything from history to memoir, essays, narrative reporting, and more. And each week is a mix of recommendations for new and older releases. Listen to For Real on Apple Podcasts or your podcatcher of choice.
I'm looking at our road atlas here, and I am figuring out where we could go off on some scenic roads or what towns we're going to be passing by.
Sorry.
In March of 2020, a group from Brooklyn Public Library went down south to Alabama. In this particular car, it was our producer, Virginia, two librarians, Nick Higgins and Edwin Maxwell, and Eva Raison, the head of outreach services at BPL. And accompanying them was an atlas of the southern states.
I have to look at the atlas now. I have some important atlas.
Leave it to librarians to be the last people in the world to follow a paper atlas in 2020.
This drive across Tennessee and into Alabama for many of the Brooklyn library workers in the car was reminiscent of the Freedom Rides along these same routes in the 1960s, when activists traveled on public buses to protest segregation on those very same buses, and then over the next few years, traveled in cars to remote areas of Mississippi to help Black people register to vote. People on both those journeys encountered violence from Southerners determined to uphold a racist system.
These moments in history nearly 60 years ago were on the minds of these library workers because this trip to Alabama was part of a fact-finding mission to see how other parts of the country talk about the history of racial violence and inequality in America. And you may be wondering, what does that have to do with a library in Brooklyn?
A whole lot, actually. Public libraries played a significant role in the civil rights movement. Famously, in 1961, nine Black students from Tougaloo College visited the white-only library in Jackson, Mississippi, and refused to leave after being told that they could not check out books. They staged a read-in and were jailed for 2 days. That event encouraged college students across the country to get involved in the civil rights movement. And there were protests and sit-ins like that at segregated public libraries before and after the Tougaloo Nine.
Racial inequality continues to have repercussions for libraries today. According to the American Library Association, 88% of librarians and 73% of library assistants are white. And the harm that was caused by segregated public libraries remains an injustice for many. The late Representative John Lewis, when he accepted the National Book Award for his graphic novel, March, in 2016, recounted his experience of walking into a public library in Troy, Alabama, when he was a child.
Some of you know, I grew up in rural Alabama, very, very poor, very few books in our home. And I remember in 1956, when I was 16 years old, with some of my brothers and sisters and cousins, going down to the public library, trying to get library cards. And we were told that the libraries were whites only and not for colors. And to come here and receive this award, this honor with this, it's too much. Thank you.
Representative Lewis would not return to that library for 57 years when he came back to Troy to do a reading and book signing at the very library that had denied him membership.
When only a generation ago, Black students could be arrested for reading in public libraries, and a future Black congressman could be made to feel so unvalued by the public library system that he would not return for decades, then public libraries have a lot of work to do to acknowledge that history and make real steps towards racial equity.
According to a report on public libraries by the Government Alliance on Race and Equity, ignoring racial disparities causes harm. The report concludes, quote, "The narrative libraries have about our own goodwill can obscure one of the most basic truths of institutional racism in the 21st century. It is most present and powerful where it is unnamed and unaddressed."
That quote is powerful for us at BPL because right now we are planning the renovation of a library branch in East New York that sits adjacent to a once unacknowledged African burial ground. We sent representatives to Selma and Montgomery all those months ago in order to help us figure out how to properly memorialize that part of Brooklyn history and how we can embody a more equitable story in the new building.
Today, we're going to dig into the history of racial violence in Alabama and here in Brooklyn. This is the first part of a two-part episode about race and racial memory in our country and in our libraries.
As always, this is a story that starts at the library. I'm Krissa Corbett-Kavoris.
And I'm Adjoa Duse. You're listening to Borrowed.
Edwin, Eva, Nick, and our producer, Virginia, arrived just in time for a yearly event in Selma when thousands of people gathered to commemorate a historic moment in civil rights history. Bloody Sunday, the march across the now famous Edmund Pettus Bridge in 1965, a march for equal voting rights that was met with violence.
On that Sunday morning in 1965, marchers set out to walk to Montgomery, Alabama. And they were met on the other side of the bridge by police carrying clubs and on horseback, as well as white onlookers with Confederate flags. State troopers beat up unarmed activists, which is how the march came to be known as Bloody Sunday. Here's sound from that day. John Lewis, who just 7 years after he was denied a library card as a child in Alabama, became chairman of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or SNCC, was at the march. He suffered a skull fracture and was taken to the hospital with 57 other marchers.
Though the march was stopped that day, 2 weeks later, even more activists than before crossed the bridge again and arrived in Montgomery. Bloody Sunday changed public opinion and led to the passage of the 1965 Voting Rights Act.
Since that pivotal day in 1965, activists and leaders have been returning to Selma every year to honor the original marchers and to continue to advocate for voting rights and civil rights that have yet to be realized for many Americans. There were thousands of people there, many members of black fraternities and sororities, as well as members of the NAACP voting rights contingent. There were also descendants of the original marchers and other Americans who make a point to return to this bridge year after year. For many of the people in Selma that day, the march was a recommitment to the fight for racial equity. Here's how Edwin Maxwell put it.
Well, there's this moment right before you get to the bridge that just kind of pauses and your heart starts fluttering. And I know I thought about the amount of courage it took for the people that walk over that bridge, not knowing what's going to happen to them on the other side, but and also knowing what's going to happen on the other side. I don't know if there's a situation today where we would have to muster enough courage to do something so imminent.
Again, listeners, this was recorded in early March. I think it's fair to say that we could and are imagining a situation where we have had to muster the courage to keep marching. On June 2nd, 2020, another group of protesters marched across a bridge, but this one was in Brooklyn. A week after George Floyd was murdered, Black Lives Matter activists took to the streets, marching from Brooklyn to Manhattan, and they were boxed in by police, trapped on the bridge for several hours. This is sound from that evening.
The work that started with the end of slavery has not stopped. It continued into the civil rights movement, and it continues today, with renewed attention on the murders of Black people by police and by vigilantes in the last few months. We are saying the names of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Rayshard Brooks, Tony McDade, Ahmaud Arbery, Jacob Blake, and more, as people all across the world are taking to the streets.
But the protests that started back in May extend beyond anger about police brutality. Institutions are looking at their own policies and attempting to correct those that perpetuate racial inequity and uphold white supremacy.
I won't say that I've ever felt like I was treated or discriminated against by staff or patrons.
That's Amon Powell Maynard, a Black woman and a children's librarian at BPL, though she is currently the civic engagement manager and directs the library's response to the 2020 census.
I will say that I've encountered, no pun intended, but I've been patronized. I've encountered sort of being dismissed by patrons, you know, unconscious bias, microaggressions.
You get used to certain expressions. Even when I say, you know, I'm a librarian, the look of surprise. And it's like, okay, well, why are you surprised by that? Is it because I'm a librarian and I'm Black, or I'm a librarian?
Vivian Parham, that last speaker, is an adult librarian at BPL. We talked to Vivian and Amon about their experiences being librarians of color. For both Amon and Vivian, the protests in May and June against police brutality were a turning point.
When George Floyd happened, I thought it was another one on the list. You know, just another killing of an unarmed Black man that we would get upset about in the Black community. Mm-hmm. And it would fizzle out, as it always does. Mm-hmm. But as I saw that there was this mass protest around the world, really, this was a global thing at first, that first week. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to do something from my home that I was stuck in, from my computer. I just needed to talk to someone else at the library about this. Like, what's happening, you know, what is this about? What are we going to do?
Something else that came up in our conversation with Iman and Vivian was the days following some of the largest protests in Brooklyn, some of which happened right in front of Brooklyn's Central Library in Grand Army Plaza. We made the decision then to put big letters spelling out BLM in the windows of our building to show support for the movement. Many staff were excited about the addition, and others wanted to push our institution to do more than put signs up.
Working with BPL leadership, Amon, Vivian, and some of their colleagues set up what we started to call real talk sessions, virtual town halls where everyone at the library could talk about how race and racism impacts them in their jobs and in their daily lives. On average, about 400 staff members showed up to each one of the four sessions.
They had a lot to say. The organization had a lot to say, and a lot of folks were uncomfortable. And a lot of folks were angry, but we're glad that we had the discussion and we opened up. I want to say we opened up some floodgates, but this is really occurring around the country at other organizations. Sort of this like social awakening. Mm-hmm. And I think it's all good. It's all great. But I still feel like we need to do a lot more, and we haven't even begun.
BPL pulled together a summary based on those sessions, and now we have our action steps, like providing workshops on how to talk about race and combating racism, and hiring more staff of color, and making sure that our leadership is as diverse as our workforce. We're also working the history and contributions made by people of color to this country into all of our programming.
And our conversation with Vivian and Amon really made me think about what it means to be a librarian as an activist. Because we are a profession that is meant to serve everyone, yet it's increasingly clear who is getting left out. It makes me think, how can libraries and librarians be actively working towards serving those in our communities that have historically not been served? How can we take care of our staff members in those communities impacted by the constant racial violence in this country, or staff who are themselves Black, Indigenous, and people of color?
Yeah, and Iman spoke to this point, that perhaps librarianship and its ideals need to change. She suggested that the ALA, the American Library Association, a governing body for library workers, should be leading us here.
We need to document this change as our profession changes, as libraries change and change with the time. And we also, in doing that, are going to have a lot of pushback from folks who believe, you know, the library is a neutral space. This is what the ALA says. This is what we've been taught. This is what I learned in library school.
I don't think that our library programs prepared us for this. They weren't, you know, we weren't prepared for social services. We weren't prepared for, you know, dealing with things like this. We were trained to find resources, you know what I mean, and do, you know, research and things like that. And but as we're seeing that it's much more than that. We have to be advocates. You know, there's a lot of hurt and pain out there that we have to talk. We have to use our voices, not be afraid.
One thing we kept coming back to in our conversation with Iman and Vivian was the need to talk about race and to tell the truth about the past.
The way we talk about our racist history is important, and it shows in what we choose to build and honor.
And that's why Brooklyn Public Library is looking at one of its own buildings that has a particular connection to that history, the branch we mentioned earlier, New Lots Library in East New York.
New Lots Library is located next to an old African burial ground where the remains of enslaved and free African people were interred. That cemetery was in use up until the 19th century and then paved over. It went unacknowledged and unmarked until several years ago when a community member, Catherine Mbali Green Johnson, dug into the archives, found documents that prove the existence and scope of the burial ground, and then worked to bring that past back into public conversation.
And it's important for our youth and anyone in the neighborhood to know that the land that they stand on and they walk on is one, sacred, and two, built by people who look like them. So the names of the streets around the community and around the library as well were all Dutch. They were largely slaveholders, right? So, you know, these folks were committed a crime, right? But we are, their cemetery is untouched. We know that history very well. It's in our books. And we study that and said incorrect, you know, historical view. We need to correct these stories.
Not many people talk about that part of Brooklyn history, nor do they talk about the racist policies that continue to impact life in East New York today.
But that's next time on Borrowed.
If you are looking for another podcast to try out, we would like to recommend Writ Large, which is a great podcast about how books change the world. Obviously, as a library, we think that's true. In every episode, the host, Zachary Davis, talks with leading scholars about one book that shaped the world we live in, whether you've heard of it or not. These conversations look beyond plot summaries, and they tell the stories behind the story. Subscribe now wherever you listen to podcasts or download the Lyceum podcast app to hear exclusive bonus episodes. That's LYCEUM. And it wouldn't be a Borrowed episode without a book match segment. We talked to Yesha Naik and Amanda Baker, who put together a list of books by and about Native American and Indigenous people.
So as you know, Indigenous Peoples Day was on Monday, October 12th, and we're celebrating Indigenous peoples throughout the year, of course, at Brooklyn Public Library and beyond, but especially the months of October and November. One way to honor them is by compiling this list of books that are about Indigenous peoples in the United States and Canada, and maybe even some that are around the world. One thing that we try to focus on is having as many books on this list that are what we call own voices books, which means simply that the books are by people who are Indigenous.
Most are ebooks, some are e-audiobooks, and these are, you can read it at any time through the months of October and November. And the reason why we did this is because we wanted to bring unity and have a sense of community during times when we can't physically be together, but to be brought together by words and by these incredible books that we found.
So this book that I wanted to share is called Take Us to Your Chief and Other Stories, and it's by Drew Hayden Taylor. It's a series of short stories that are science fiction, Traditional topics of science fiction are covered, from invaders from the outside world, as well as space travel. But Drew Hayden Taylor, who hails from the Curve Lake First Nations, also in Canada, and he's an Ojibwe writer, and he basically has like a fresh take on these very classic sci-fi tropes, you know, basically comparing like the implications of alien contact that we see in traditional sci-fi to, of course, the arrival of white people in the Americas, for example.
The second book I would like to talk about is Our History is the Future, Standing Rock versus the Dakota Access Pipeline and the Long Tradition of Indigenous Resistance. Super, super long title, but very, very important. It's by Nick Estes. And this book kind of talks about that easily since 1857 and earlier up until today, Indigenous peoples have struggled tremendously to secure their land, to secure rights. And so in the book, we also see United States citizens as well as tribal citizens fighting to ensure that this pipeline doesn't get created because of the devastating impacts on the environment it would have. Definitely an excellent and well-written read that will have even the most reluctant of nonfiction readers turning the page.
Thank you guys so much for all those wonderful recommendations.
Thank you for having us on the podcast.
Borrowed is brought to you by Brooklyn Public Library and is hosted by me, Adjo Aduse, and Krissa Corbett-Cavores. You can find a transcript of this episode at our website, bklynlibrary.org/podcast.
Borrowed is produced by Virginia Marshall and written by Virginia Marshall and Adjoa Aduse, with help from Pritzi Bodenheimer, Jennifer Prophet, Meryl Friedman, and Robin Lester Kenton. Our music composer is Billy Libby.
Borrowed will be back in a few weeks. Until then, keep marching.